You're listening to a classic business podcast as heard on Classic 1027. 1027.
Last week, we touched on what I find to be a really interesting topic around global minimum company tax rates, and it feeds into one of the big themes for the year, which is this breakdown of the social contract and an inflection point between the haves and the have-nots. The pandemic has certainly exposed the fragility of our social contracts, and to thrive in the future, I think business certainly must be aware of and play a role in rebuilding these contracts. So too do state actors, and indeed anyone in any position of influence and leadership. And one cannot ignore the extent to which hugely indebted governments now are facing a real serious issue around legacy tax bases that some new tech-enabled business models that have blossomed thanks to COVID have now ushered in. And if you add to this, we've got the various antitrust investigations, which are the competition investigations that we know of here happening over in the US and in China. We've got likely higher tax rates for tech in the US. And the game has to change. Now, Andrew Bradley, CEO at fiscal.co.za, a wealth management company, was chatting to me about this last week. And Andrew, really fascinating. We just didn't have enough time to take it to its full conclusion. So thanks to thanks for joining me and for coming back on to the show. I hope you've been keeping well.
Very well, thank you, Michael, and thanks very much for having me back. It's always a pleasure. But I guess when you're trying to solve the problems of the world, it does take more than a couple of minutes.
And just in the last few days, we've had, you know, further evidence of this theme, haven't we? We've had the Biden administration talking about doubling capital gains taxes. We've had this issue around Meituan shrugging off the broadening e-commerce crackdown in China. And a large part of that is regulatory pressure. You've got workers demanding a living wage and benefits for riders. All of this takes place in this environment where it does feel like the social contract is fraying. Just recap where we left off last week on the importance of the social contract. What are we talking about here?
Well, if we take the social contract as us as individuals, and we have numerous social contracts, but the basic one being between us as citizens of a country, saying we will pay taxes, and in return, our government need to provide us with a variety of services, and that is, you know, from schooling, education, healthcare, safety, and so we can go on, and various governments, you know, draw the line at various points, but in essence, that's the nature of that social contract. We have, you know, other social contracts in terms of relationships with friends and spouses, and so they go on. And each of those are premised on a number of critical fundamentals. And, you know, the key one, which we touched on, which was breaking down, and in my opinion, has broken down, and we're calling sort of almost the last rites on it right now, is the social contract between citizens and their governments. Because governments are coming under increasing pressure because they can't and will not into the future be able to deliver on that social contract. And people are seeing themselves getting poorer, getting less services, feeling more insecure as, you know, the realities of not just this pandemic, which is in some respects accelerated some of the realities, and in others actually masked over them. But I think the premise of how the social contract has been funded, and particularly if you look at over the last 30 years or so in terms of the concept of globalization, where we had the workers in poorer countries, and by that sometimes Africa, but predominantly into Asia at the time, providing manufacturing goods for the consuming nations in the West, and they could do it significantly cheaper. They did that. They provide these goods into the likes of America. So who benefited from that? Well, American consumers benefited from that. Who lost out to that? Well, the losers were the lower level blue collar workers in Western countries, and predominantly America. And further, who benefited from it? Well, it was the large corporations, because not only could they now get their goods produced significantly cheaper, so the consumers there benefit, but they also, through various structures, started paying a lot less tax because they would route some of these goods through, you know, tax havens and the like, which then meant, excuse me, that they would pay less tax, and therefore those corporations became a lot more profitable and a lot more valuable. So investors, and by and large, mostly high net worth individuals, were the beneficiaries. So that was what was happening. And now we're finding that governments can no longer meet those commitments because they're not getting the tax revenue. Their workers who have lost their jobs need some social security, and they can't do that. And now, on top of that, they have a tax burden because of COVID. So in a very brief nutshell, that's the essence of the problem. And we're seeing now the rich getting richer and the poor getting poorer because with COVID, those that have been able to work have been okay, and those corporations that were able to exploit the situation have become incredibly profitable, and because of their tax structuring, paying little to no tax, where those that haven't been able to benefit from this are really, really not only because of the mental health issues and being isolated and all the rest, but desperate in not being able to work, is going to have a long-lasting impact on many people around the world. So a huge challenge, and that's why, as you mentioned, you know, the likes of President Biden now saying, well, how do we fund this and how do we do this? And everyone's scratching their head and trying different solutions to how we fix this, because at the one end, President Biden saying, well, let's tax the wealthy through capital gains tax because people have made insane amounts of credit, insane amounts of wealth, whereas those who haven't been able to have lost nearly everything. So that's one way. Now, then there's another solution put on the table saying, well, let's have a global tax rate to avoid companies moving money around and paying no tax because, as we are aware, the Fortune 500 companies, more than 90 of them are paying zero tax. So those are the challenges, and I think all of this is going to see a significant sort of shifting of various dynamics. So if you are an Apple shareholder, and Apple is a company that's having stuff made in China, routing stuff through, Ireland, not paying any tax, and now, what's going to happen to your profits? What's going to happen to, the dynamics of the services that you provide? All of that is going to come into question, and that's going to have significant impacts on investments as well.
It's an absolutely massive theme, and one that flows through into almost every facet of the market at the moment. If you look at the way it's driving ESG and factor investing, people are looking at the environmental, but there's also the government and the social issues that are going to guide investment decision making into the future. But I want to hone in on one specific area here, if we can, just quickly, Andrew, and that is also, what we're seeing as the individual as a saver in all of this. And you've spoken about the individual as a worker, and touched on it as an individual as a saver, saving for their retirement. Because what we're also seeing here, aren't we, is that, we're living longer in this world where there are these increasing pressures and the breakdown of the social contract and delivery of those services that we would have been accustomed to receiving potentially in our retirement. But what we're also seeing is that there's this greater responsibility on our own shoulders to take control of that retirement journey, as we see around the world shift from defined benefit to defined contribution funds. But with that happening and aging populations and living longer, it just looks like the pressure is almost overwhelming, and that we're not saving enough. Firstly, we're not taking enough ownership and responsibility. And generationally, if we don't get ahead of this, we really are setting ourselves up for a massive headache down the line.
Fully agreed. And so the one aspect is not saving enough. And for many people, it's because they are feeling very vulnerable. Some of their cash flows, are at the point where they don't have any surplus to actually save. So, they've got a serious problem coming, and therefore will be at one level or another dependent on their governments. And we've already seen, just because of that, you know, many governments around the world trying to raise the level and the age of when you're entitled to social benefits. And we've seen the yellow vests and the likes in France and other parts of Europe who, you know, rejected that and objected to it. But the reality is that, you know, if you had to take it in a pure actuarial sense, most of those governments are insolvent and can't meet their current commitments, and that's why there has to be this change. But then there's the second aspect to it, that even those that are saving, you know, at the moment, by and large, they've got very, very good returns from their investments because of the reasons that I've alluded to up front, is that because of low tax rates and you know, exploiting some of the Asian workers and in, you know, sweatshops and the likes, but I mean, that's, you know, let's not go down that rabbit hole, but let's just say they're paying lower wages there than they would in other Western countries. Companies have made profits, and therefore, from an investment point of view, us as an investor have done very, very well. So what I'm trying to highlight with this is that that dynamic could and most likely will change, because companies, I don't believe, will be making the profits that they were in the past, because the social contract and the rules of the game will change. It will be far more difficult for them to make the profits that they have, because, you know, tax rates and ways of avoiding tax will also change. I think there's also another aspect as to when, how those consumers around the world will, you know, earn their income or earn the benefits to be able to consume. And I think we're seeing a massive shift as well to Asia, where, you know, in the past, sort of, the Asians used to make the televisions for Americans to watch, but now, you know, they're buying their own televisions, and from a global trade point of view, things aren't just all flowing to the West, they also flowing into Asia. So the whole power base at a global level is also changing, which has other implications and consequences. So, as you know, when you are strategically relevant, you make rules. When you are no longer that relevant, you have the rules thrust upon you. And in some respects, you know, this is the basis on which Donald Trump got into power. This is the basis on which he was fighting some of these sort of part of the policies he was implementing to fight against China and the like, because it was inevitable what was happening. Not saying that how he went about it was the right way, in my humble opinion, but, you know, you understand what he was trying to achieve and what they were trying to do. The consequences, I think, were significantly negative on American consumers and American, by and large, American workers. Again, the irony, the beneficiaries of that were the large corporations. So all of these dynamics are going to come into play, and I think what's going to happen is that there certainly will be winners and losers, and there'll be those inflection points, you know, like we saw with moving from the horse and buggy cart to a motor car. There was a change in dynamic, you know, as we saw from the news, you know, from watching, you know, videos and blockbusters to a Netflix. So those inflection points weren't gradual. You know, one day this worked and the next day it didn't. And I think those, from an investment point of view, the companies that are successful now, some will continue, but the rules of the game will change substantially for others. And that will have massive impacts on our savings for retirement and sustaining ourselves in retirement.
That's the million rand, million dollar, million yuan question, isn't it? How do you, as a saver for long-term goals such as retirement, with all of these uncertainties, with the global dynamic shifting beneath your feet, how do you plan for a future that is a whole lot more difficult to predict?
Well, it becomes, it always has been fraught with various risks. I mean, in South Africa, in many respects, we went through it with the advent of our democracy. There were different rules. We had our democracy and now a new set of rules, and the implications and consequences for companies changed dramatically. And you know, those companies that thrived pre-post-apartheid and after that are very, very different. And so we always need to look to the future. The premise of all of this is that the future will be better, because if it's not better, well, what's the point of it? And for that, we've got to be flexible. We've got to be pragmatic. We cannot be stuck in the past. And we've got to keep looking, saying, what I have right now, is this correctly positioned for the future? And things will need to adapt. Things will need to evolve. And so I think we are very fortunate and blessed in South Africa to have a number of excellent quality asset managers who are looking at these things and are grappling with them. And the reality is, no one's going to get it all right all the time. There's not being stuck in the way of saying, well, that's what worked in the past and it will work in the future. That, to me, is the problem. So those who are forward-looking, which is most of them, will keep looking and searching and evolving and find these new solutions and find the new structures that will work and the new environment that will work. So it's not doom and gloom. It's certainly going to be tougher, in my opinion. But I'm not overly concerned. I think, as I said right up front, my big concern is I think the problems are fairly obvious for most of us. It's what the solutions are, which are fairly difficult. But, we mustn't look too far into the future to try and find the ultimate solution that's going to be there in 20 years' time. We need to say, that's the trend. This is where things are going. How do we structure ourselves? And how do we ensure that we are flexible enough that we can adapt and evolve as things progress over time? Because some things will happen very, very quickly and others will take a little bit of more time. Yeah. But it's being ready and prepared for that. So if you've done nothing, you're going to be in trouble. If you've saved, at least you are on the right path, and it will be a rocky road that you're going to be traveling on. But at least, sometimes you can go a little bit faster and sometimes you'll have to go very, very slowly and cautiously.
I think viewed from the perspective of the social contract for individual savers, it is a time like a few others in terms of being able to position yourself with that flexibility and that foresight as well. Andrew Bradley, CEO at www.fiscal.co.za, a boutique wealth management company, with what the impact of the breakdown in the social contract means from a broad macro perspective, and also how it's going to impact all of us on our path to saving for retirement. Anne Williams is standing by with your news.